Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Free Speech, Campus Arrests, and Deportations. Recorded in 2025, host Jim Falk is joined by Paul Butler, a First Amendment attorney and partner at Jackson Walker, and Jeremy Suri, presidential historian and Mack Brown Distinguished Professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Together, they examine the growing pressure on free speech and academic freedom in the United States, from the detention of foreign students to the defunding of universities that resist government demands. Their conversation explores what the First Amendment does and doesn't protect, and what's at stake when those rights go undefended. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
I'm Jim Falk, and welcome to Perspectives Matter. The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protects speech. Speech that some may find offensive, but it is a fundamental part of our democracy. How the government is now detaining students and sometimes professors is unprecedented and is putting extraordinary pressure on our universities. Cancellation or withholding of funding to American universities due to actions or speech that the government doesn't like, many say represents the greatest threat on academic institutions since the Red Scare of the 1950s and the days of Joseph McCarthy. In recent weeks, an Ivy League university, Columbia, and major law firms have bowed to government demands out of fear that to not do so, they might just suffer injurious harm. To go behind the headlines, we have with us two nationally known experts on the First Amendment, the U.S. Constitution, and academic freedom. Jeremy Suri, a frequent guest of the program, is a presidential historian at the University of Texas at Austin, where he is the Mack Brown Distinguished Professor for Global Leadership, History, and Public Policy. He's the author of 9 books, last time I counted, on contemporary politics and foreign policy. He and his son Zachary host a weekly podcast, This is Democracy, and they also publish a weekly newsletter on Substack, This is Democracy, and they also publish a weekly newsletter on Substack, Democracy of Hope. Now here with me in the studio is Paul Butler. He's an attorney and partner with Jackson Walker, also a nationally recognized expert in First Amendment law with extensive experience representing media clients on defamation and libel claims. Gentlemen, always fun to have you with us, especially on such an important and sadly timely topic. Before we really get into what's happening at universities, Paul, I'd like you to just give us a basic definition of the First Amendment. And I might add, it is the First Amendment.
Exactly. It's First Amendment adopted as part of the Bill of Rights, actually after the Constitution was adopted in 1789. And there was a movement among the founders that there be specific provisions for protecting personal liberties, which the main document didn't cover. So the First Amendment basically guarantees 5 different freedoms: freedom of expression, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, we should say, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, exercise of religion, free exercise of religion. It prohibits the government from establishing a state religion, and it also guarantees the right of free association. So really what we're concerned about today, principally, is the right of free speech, which is an integral part of the First Amendment.
Now, Jeremy, you're at the University of Texas at Austin, a public university. What is the difference between the rights or obligations of a public university versus, say, private university here in Dallas at SMU?
A public university must follow the First Amendment. We are a public institution, and so the Constitution applies to us full stop. Private institutions are often given a little more space to make private decisions about how they want to use their resources. They still cannot violate the First Amendment, but they are given more, I think, leeway, and Paul could talk about that in more detail and more knowledge than I can. But it is not up to the University of Texas whether it wants to follow the First Amendment or not. As a public institution in the United States, it is obligated, full stop, to follow every element, every piece, every part of the jurisprudence surrounding the First Amendment.
Jeremy's absolutely right. I mean, the First Amendment is actually sort of a negative guarantee. It prohibits the government from doing certain things. It doesn't prevent necessarily private actors from doing things. And private universities would be private actors. Public universities, such as the University of Texas at Austin, is a public institution. And so it's a state actor when it uses police power or whatever in the name of campus order, for instance, that results in speech being denied. So it's acting as an arm of the state, if you will, and is definitely fully subject to the First Amendment.
What is Title VI, and how does that pertain to what we're discussing?
Title VI is part of educational amendments that were adopted by the Congress that also guarantees the right of free speech. It's somewhat redundant of the First Amendment, but it's a statutory guarantee of free speech in the campus setting.
And that's one of the issues that the government used pertaining to Columbia University.
Yeah, I think that was more at play last year than this year when the actual campus protests were going on. The effort to deport the graduate student at Columbia. Well, and also, I think you may be referring to...
Well, that gets back to the
denying the federal funding.
Right, yes, the federal funding.
Yes, that money can be withheld by the government in certain circumstances if universities are not compliant with the requirements of, say, Title VI.
And staying on the First Amendment, Jeremy, I know you've thought about this a great deal and written about it. People can say hateful things. The fine line is whether or not you are threatening someone's security, their bodily security.
So in general, and again, Paul is the expert on this, but in general, our jurisprudence has given a lot of leeway to a speaker. You have to show direct and imminent harm from someone saying something. You cannot just say you don't like what they say. So I am, of course, opposed to anti-Semitism. I am Jewish myself, but people have a right to make anti-Semitic comments in a free society, just as they have a right to make anti-Muslim comments. Again, I renounce those comments personally, but people have a right to say them. At universities, there is a little more leeway for universities to restrict speech because Title VI does provide certain protections against harassment. So in a university setting, someone can have an offensive view and they can express it, particularly at a protest, and they have every right to do that. But if they are following a student around and calling them names in ways that are anti-Semitic or anti-Muslim, that could be deemed harassment and they could be asked to leave the university for that reason. They would still have the right to say those things outside of the university. But within a university, we do have protections against students being harassed. But even there, the bar has to be pretty high. I can't claim I'm being harassed because I don't like what someone says. I have to show they are actually preventing me from studying in this context of the university that I'm attending.
Well, that's a key and interesting point, because when we talked about this, God, it's almost been a year ago when we were talking about the protest on American universities, prohibiting or making it difficult for someone to attend class. That's a fine line.
Exactly. So any kind of physical activity, particularly that blocks somebody or that involves in restraining their physical freedom, the right of movement, or something like that, that crosses the line, generally speaking, between free speech and activity that's not protected by the First Amendment. So there's pure speech itself is usually, not always, but most often protected by the First Amendment. Speech that incites an imminent likelihood of violence may be regulated, or speech that really crosses the line into actual activity of assaulting somebody or
don't
trespassing.
Cry fire in the theater.
Exactly. Trespassing, those sort of things, that's not protected speech.
So I don't know if you all know this. Years ago, I worked at the Institute of International Education, which administers the Fulbright grant and thousands of foreign students, and knew just enough about the J-1 visa to be dangerous. But the J-1 visa is the one that most exchange students have. And that's what we're seeing now in the case of some of these students who may be deported. Paul, someone who's here on a visa, what responsibility are they under the terms, say, of the U.S. Constitution?
To some degree, generally speaking, anybody within the United States, found within the United States, that has lawfully entered the United States has a First Amendment rights, the right of free speech. They might not have all the due process rights that a citizen would have or a permanent lawful resident would have. So the actual right to speak out is protected to anyone that's found within the country. Now, on the other hand, there are certain statutes, and they come into play in the Columbia University situation, that give the government or government officials, such as the Secretary of State, to make determinations that somebody's presence in the United States is adverse to the foreign policy interests of the United States, as an example, and so they can be removed. Generally, people who are lawful permanent residents have greater rights than just visa holders, whether it's a student visa or a tourist visa.
What about a green card? Because that is a permanent resident.
Exactly. A green card holder is a so-called lawful permanent resident. Their protections approach but don't really quite equal the rights of a citizen to either exercise a right of free speech or due process rights. Generally speaking, lawful permanent residents, green card holders, have the right to have full due process, to challenge some adverse action that is taking away their right to be in the country, or their right to speak out, whatever that may be. Usually those rights cannot be denied to a lawful permanent resident or a citizen without the exercise of due process, which means there has to be some sort of legal proceeding, has to be some sort of adjudication before those rights can be taken away or denied.
So the first case that's happened in recent weeks in the United States was the Algerian, Mahmoud Khalil, yeah, who had a green card.
Yes.
So elaborate on that.
Yeah, so Mr. Khalil had a green card. He was a leader, had been a leader of campus protests against Israeli involvement and military involvement in Gaza, particularly last year. He'd spoken out. Some of those protests did involve, in some instances, physical violence, blockading buildings, sit-ins, that sort of thing. But he himself had never been accused of any kind of crime. So he was arrested on a Saturday night. And first he was told that his student visa had
been... They entered his apartment.
I believe that's right. And when he pointed out that he's a green card holder, he was informed that his green card had been revoked by the Secretary of State. And indeed, there is a statute that does authorize the Secretary of State to revoke green card status for persons that the Secretary determines their presence in the United States is adverse to the foreign policy of the United States. So, but this also, that's a statute, and statutes, generally speaking, can't trump constitutional rights since it's a right of free speech. So here we have a collision of whether this broad authority to permit or disallow people to be in the United States that is vested in the Secretary of State, if he can exercise that, if the real reason he's exercising it is merely the expression of free speech protected by the First Amendment. Generally speaking, most people would say the courts would prohibit that. And this case sets that up to be adjudicated in Mr. Khalil's case.
Now, you said the Secretary of State has the authority to do this, and they're using making an argument about foreign policy, national security. What about if it's a case that has to do with some other crime, or that would be the Attorney General, right? I mean, that has nothing
sure
to do with the Secretary.
Right. I mean, if someone has actually engaged in criminal activity, they can be excluded from the country if they're a green card holder in certain circumstances. And certainly people under student visas or tourist visas could also be excluded from the country. It doesn't give them any particular protection. The green card status does not give that holder of the green card special protection against arrest and detention. It does give particular protections against actual removal. So they have the right to be heard in court, the right to raise objections and legal reasons why they should not be excluded before they can actually be removed.
But if you had a J-1 visa or a student exchange visa, you might not have those rights?
And I'm no expert on student visas, but generally speaking, those types of visas connote fewer rights in the holder of the visa versus a green card resident or a citizen.
Because, Jeremy, back to my IIE days in Student International Education, if students overstayed their visa or did not attend class or meet certain academic requirements, we were required to write that up and their visa could be revoked.
We have those same procedures today. I'm often asked questions by different organizations about Fulbright scholars and others, especially if they attended class, because they have an obligation as part of their student visa to actually be a student. And that's perfectly reasonable. But just to build on Paul's point, it is significant, and I say this as a historian and a textualist, that the 14th Amendment, which talks about due process, we've talked about the First Amendment, the 14th Amendment does not distinguish between citizens and persons. It is very intentionally written to say that all persons within the jurisdiction of the United States are entitled to due process. So we have had many cases over the years, Jim, I'm sure you had these too, where a student does something they're not supposed to do under their student visa, and they can indeed be deported, but there has to be a due process around that. I cannot just send a letter to someone who then shows up at that student's home and puts them in handcuffs and sends them to Louisiana and then Guantanamo. This is ridiculous, actually, I'm sorry to say. We would have a process by which that student would be confronted with the evidence, that student would have the right to respond, and there would be an impartial adjudicator. And then the impartial adjudicator could initiate a penalty process. That is how due process should work. I think it's very important that those watching this program look at some of these videos of how these individuals at Columbia, at Tufts, and at various other universities have been arrested. They have been arrested Soviet style, where a bunch of people show up at their house and put them in handcuffs and take them away from their families without even a formal charge.
There's a recent one of the young woman, I believe it was at Tufts, walking out of an apartment with her friends, and she was arrested just very recently.
And if I might say, Jim, I don't understand why anyone would condone this, because once one administration starts to do this, another administration could do this. And tomorrow it could be people with exactly the other point of view in office who would use this extraordinary power. I don't want either side to have this power.
What do you think, or what is the ripple effect, Jeremy, on campuses? I mean, I can't imagine that this is not one of the top things that you and your colleagues are discussing together as well as with your students.
Yes. So we are in, I think, another McCarthyite moment. We are in a moment where people are afraid, especially foreign students and foreign scholars, including foreign professors, those who were not born in the U.S., are afraid to speak out and express their opinions on certain issues, even in the most civil environment. They would rather not talk about the Middle East right now, even scholars of the Middle East, because they are afraid of what will happen. It is hard to bring visitors to campus. And I will say, even those of us like myself who have tenure, who were born in the United States, we find ourselves asking ourselves, by bringing this issue up, am I exposing my students, especially a student in the classroom who might be from a foreign country, to being mistreated? There has been a chilling effect. And I think it's very similar to what I understand happened on university campuses in the 1950s around other issues, but in a similar way. And that cloud of fear is harming the educational environment for students of all backgrounds and perspectives.
You know, Jeremy used the word, Paul, chilling. And you think about how Columbia University basically has bowed down to the government. I cannot imagine the Middle East Department being very happy about saying they're under this committee and being reviewed. What recourse do universities have?
Well, there's legal processes, but my understanding just from press reports is that Columbia probably made some calculation that fighting the administration over in this particular instance would likely be much more costly than some form of compliance with what the administration wanted. So we're in a situation where, yes, we still have the laws on the books, but people have been chilled at exercising both their rights to legal redress and rights to freedom of speech, rights to freely associate by attending the universities of their choices, particularly foreigners and other categories of people that are in the United States. So chilling effect is something that the First Amendment is very concerned about and seeks to prevent happening. But I think there's a fair amount of evidence that there's a great chilling effect being exerted currently.
Jeremy, you mentioned that you're Jewish, and I thought it was very interesting to read that a lot of the Jewish students at Columbia are very concerned about some of the actions that Columbia has taken. And I wonder how you might elaborate on that.
I think there are many ways to answer that excellent question. I mean, the most obvious one is that I think those who are from minority groups of all kinds, and Jews are a minority, we recognize how vitally important the First Amendment is. This is why I'm so grateful for all the work that Paul does to defend the First Amendment, because the people who need free speech most are those who are the most vulnerable. powerful people will always find a way to get their opinions heard. And that's okay. That's fine. If you have power, you should use your power. But those who have less power, they're the ones who need these protections. That's why the revolutionaries, those who created our republic, wanted these freedoms. They wanted to be free from British tyranny as they perceived it. And so as a Jew, I've always felt that very strongly, that the Bill of Rights is there to protect people from communities who in other countries where there were no Bill of Rights, where we suffered an enormous physical harm. I don't have to get into the details of that with you. And there is a part of our tradition, and I think other religions have this tradition too, where we remind ourselves that they might be coming for someone else, but if we support them when they go after someone else, they're probably going to come after us.
And obviously that's very important on an individual basis, but also, as you've said earlier, when a different political party comes into power, we may see the same.
Exactly. Precedent set under Republican administration will apply to a Democratic president. And sometimes when the standard is a very amorphous standard, such as under this Immigration and Nationality Act provision invoked here, where it says that the Secretary of State may determine that the presence of someone has adverse consequences to the foreign policy of the United States, that can be interpreted in so many ways, in so many different circumstances. It could go 180 degrees the other way in the next administration. So,
I want to pivot just a little bit away from universities and take advantage of you being here, Paul. ABC paid, $15 million as a settlement regarding a program that George Stephanopoulos did. You're seeing discussions with CBS and Paramount. Where is this going?
Well, there's concern that it's sort of what was alluded to earlier, that there's so much pressure on people these days to conform to what the administration expectations for them might be. And there's concern that exercising otherwise protected rights may jeopardize your standing in the community, your standing in your business, your standing in your ability to carry on a particular profession, that people are looking for alternative ways to resolve this. And people, institutions, corporations, sometimes choose to take what they perceive to be a smoother path rather than vocally or strenuously exercising legal rights to contest it. And I think we've seen that in some occasions in cases brought against the news media, brought by President Trump as well as others. And this is a fairly new phenomenon. Usually news organizations were well known in the United States, yes, backed by a very strong First Amendment to not settle those kinds of cases. So you can never say that it would never happen before, but it's happening in different circumstances and has a different flavor to it these days.
I'm not asking you obviously to disclose who you represent, but are you getting calls from some of your clients about how to handle this?
Well, there's definitely an increase of activity, and particularly in the area of defamation. We see a lot more of it being brought against the news media. We see it having more political overtones than in years past. I mean, those kinds of cases previously brought against journalists, news organizations were usually brought by local citizens who claimed their standing in the community had been diminished. Nowadays, so many of these cases have very stark political overtones to them. So that's kind of new and different, and there is a proliferation of them these days.
Something new that's happening, too, is, you know, shortly after the new administration came in, DEI was removed in most cases, but words were moved, and not just diversity or equity, inclusion, but words like bias or fairness, racism. Where does this fit in? Is it freedom of speech or is freedom to use words?
Well, of course, you know, an agency of the government has some discretion to instruct employees on what they can say about particular issues. But still, I mean, individuals retain their
rights. But only within their scope of work.
Generally speaking, that's exactly right. So if you're outside of a workplace, you can't prohibit someone from speaking out about those things. But, you know, all these choices have certain values implicit in them. And we're living in a time when what has been generally accepted as common understanding, a common way to proceed on these kinds of issues, the normative considerations are just being cast aside, and it's a new landscape. It's definitely seems to be an effort to test how far the president's authority will go, how far in the executive branch things can be changed until either Congress or the courts or the people as a political body step in and say, that's too far.
What role does Congress have? It seems to me that it's going to go to the courts pretty soon.
Well, Congress has a great deal of authority, including the power of the purse. But since the Trump administration has taken office, the second administration.
And the fact that Congress is controlled now by the president's party.
Obviously, there's majorities in both houses in the Republican Party, the president's party. And so far, there's been little outcry, if any, certainly at a leadership level, virtually none, that disfavors what Mr. Trump has been doing. But, you know, majorities can change. It's a thin majority in both houses. And certainly Congress theoretically has the power to exercise extensive checks and balances on the executive, whether or not the particular house under control of a particular party chooses to do that is essentially a political determination.
And it is an unbelievably close majority,
exactly.
Because I just saw recently that President Trump's nomination for UN ambassador is going to be withdrawn because they
protect
need to
seat.
Have that. Yeah, they need to protect that seat. Jeremy, you wrote a piece for Democracy of Hope, Why Free Speech Matters More Than Ever. Do your students understand that?
Yes, I think one of the silver linings in this very difficult moment is that when our rights are under attack, we don't take them for granted. And I think we came to this moment in part because for a long time, we forgot why these rights were so important, and we didn't recognize that there were people on both sides of the spectrum, maybe more so on one side now, but in general on both sides, who would, for their own reasons, like to take these rights away. Powerful people don't like when people say things they don't want to hear. And at this moment, we're reminded why these rights matter so much. So in that sense, it's a great teaching moment. It's a difficult teaching moment because of what you just discussed so well with Paul, that there are certain topics we have to be careful how we talk about, and
right.
People can get angry and complain, and they're complaining more than ever because they don't want to hear about slavery.
And indeed, that's part of our system. And I wish I could give you total free speech right now, but I got to cut you off. And I want to thank you both for being with us. And, you know, really, gentlemen, as we've discussed, constitutional law scholars across the political spectrum believe that the First Amendment and academic freedom are under attack. As recent events demonstrate so well, so clearly, our right to speak out freely can and must never be taken for granted. It is incumbent for all of us as citizens to be informed, to speak out, make our views known if we feel that our rights are being usurped, that we can talk about these things that matter with people who care. That's a privilege, and we hold dear in value. I want to thank all of you for watching, where we talk about things that matter, indeed, with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.